self is invited to go back to our breathing, so that our collective energy of mindfulness will bring us together as an organism, flowing as a river, with no more separation. But the whole song of breathe as one body, generate peace as one body, be free as one body. Let us transcend the boundaries of the belief self, liberating from the superiority complex, the inferiority complex, and the equality complex. Sangha is invited to go back to our breathing, so that our collective energy of mindfulness will bring us together as an organism, going as a river with no more separation. Let the whole Sangha body breathe, let the whole Sangha breathe as one body, generate peace as one body, be free as one body. Let us transcend the boundaries of the delusive self, liberating from the superiority complex, the inferiority complex, and the equality complex.
So this is one body of how an individual's spiritual or transformative process developing into a community process helps in the healing and transformation of the world. Obviously, as said, peace begins with us. So the meditative life, the spiritual life, is where we stop always expecting everyone else in the world to act right. To be peaceful, to be loving, to be kind, to be just to one another. We realize, it's got to begin with me. Right? Because if one person cannot do it within oneself, then how can a group of people do it among each other? The individual instruction is to become a truly peaceful, harmonious, loving, kind, compassionate, intelligent, wise human being. The best that we can, we use the practices of a spiritual path to facilitate that, to heal what needs to be healed, to transform what needs to be transformed, to understand what needs to be understood, so we truly have the capacity of living an awakened life. But then, there is community, as expressed in that gatha, whereby the whole world may not be ready to live fully as one organism, to breathe in mindfulness, and to recognize that we are one body, and to overcome the separation of ego and self, and looking as opposed to the rest of humanity or the world or the earth as worse than or better than or all those various complexes. So spiritual community is sort of the next step. Is an attempt by those people who have personally undertaken a path of spiritual transformation, awakening, to say, let me come together and learn to live that way with my fellow human beings, right? To live in harmony, to be compassionate, to be understanding, to be loving, to learn to live in mindfulness together, right? And then, in a very kind of on the ground, nitty gritty kind of way, the world begins to be transformed from the bottom up. This doesn't obviate the need for the types of reformations or transformations, the social, political, economic, et cetera, type of interventions. But it means there's got to be some ground other than political, social struggle, domination, control, right? And that can only happen from this type of bottom-up transformation that occurs in the development of true spiritual communities, where we demonstrate within our own personal life, our families, our relationship with friends, and within our spiritual community, that we have the capacity of living in this way. To understand that we are one organism. And when we understand that we all are part of one organism, then we understand that if I do harm to myself and everyone else, I am harming the organism, which is me. Right? If my arm sees itself as independent of the body and just goes its own way, right? Hurting other parts of the body or harming itself or not taking, we clearly understand how that will affect the well-being of the whole body. Even though the arm or the hand may be going, oh, I'm just alone in this. I'm just an arm, right? Because the arm by itself doesn't have the wisdom to see the interconnection. It's connected to the whole organism. The same way that most human beings, unfortunately, do not see the organism of life, right? Of humans, of animals, insects, flora, fauna, the earth, the sky, you know, how we are all one organism, truly breathing together. So this is a very wonderful gatha. It's a poem. It invites us to, at least in the meditation room, to begin to practice that way. That's to practice as one body, awareness that we are one body. And hopefully it is a something that will grow as we begin more and more to understand the interbeing, the interconnection, the interdependence of all life. There is no separation. And this is both a very personal, spiritual realization, but most importantly, it is a societal understanding that must occur if we are to survive. So it's a very wonderful chapter. Thank you for reminding us. So before we return to the teachings of the Chinese Chan or Zen master Lin Shi, of which Thich Nhat Hanh is, I think he's 24th or 26th in the lineage of Lin Shi when it came from China into Vietnam. Lin Shi is his great ancestor, his great grandfather, many grandfathers. Are there any general questions about the practice of mindfulness and meditation, or about the application of the teachings of mindfulness and Buddhism, Dharma, to daily life? Yes.
Could you clarify what is meaning liberation from the context of the quality.
Yeah, that's, I know, that's, most of us have heard about inferiority complexes and superiority complexes. So it's an interesting one. I think most people, when we hear it the first time, we go, what? That's a new one. And I was the same way. The equality complex, it really, again, you know, in Buddhism, it really says all identifications with a reified permanent self are delusive. And so I think what this is saying is the self, I mean, when one lives in a self, we find that we take various strong stances. Some people take a strong stance of superiority complex. I am better than everyone else, more important than everyone else. My needs are most important, my wants are most important, my intelligence is better, my belief system, you know what I mean, that's superiority complex. You know, other people take the opposite stance. They take the stance of deficiency. I am less than. I am deficient. I am broken. I am unworthy. I am unlovable. Right. So many people take the stance of inferiority. Right. But again, in terms of kind of at the heart of Buddhism, it both are, we could say, deluded, because both are seeing a fixed self of which one is attributing various types of characteristics, but one still believes it's true. The way I understand the equality complex is the one which says, I'm as good as you, right? Why should you have a seat? I should be in the seat. You know what I mean? Why should Andy hit the bell? I'm as good as Andy, I should hit the bell. It's sort of the complex that's, it's kind of like jealous and, is always saying, how come I'm not in front of the line? I'm as good as. But again, it's an ego stance. You know, it's like, you have good fortune. Hey, how come I don't have good fortune? Right? I mean, I deserve it. You got a raise. I should have gotten a raise as much as you. I mean, I'm as good as you. It doesn't acknowledge differences. You know, some people are smarter than other people. Some people are more talented than other people. Some people are more coordinated than other people. Some people get ahead better than others. You know what I'm saying? So there is, it overcomes that jealousy. So it's an interesting, I think, in terms of complexes of the ego. I think it's a quite interesting addition to our traditional inferiority superiority. It really kind of says whatever stance you take is going to be problematic. It's going to lead you to fighting with somebody. Does that? Yeah. Any other questions or about practice? And your own meditation practice or the application of practice to daily life. Yes?
In meditation, often I deal with anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
And, obsession, anxiety. You're talking about in meditation, you want to let go of the mind. I'll get rid of any of that thought.
Well, Let me just say something first about that. Again, this is very important. We're not getting rid of thought. We're getting rid of our attachment or involvement or obsession with thought. It's allowing thought just to come and go without attaching meaning to them. Okay? That's important because if many people think, meditation is about I got to get rid of, right? I got to stop. But that's not really what it's about at all. Because anxiety-producing type thoughts, right? I mean, in and of themselves, they have no power unless we attach belief to them or truth to them, right? I mean, I can say, a car is going to zoom off of 41 any minute now and come crashing in, and it's going to kill all of us, right? That one could consider that an anxiety producing thought, right? If one believes it was true and about to happen. Right? But in and of itself, I mean, I can say that and have no anxiety at all, right? Because I don't attach any meaning or belief to it. So it's a much easier job than, getting rid of. Right? In other words, it's not as if I can never have a thought that has the possibility of producing anxiety in me again. Because that may not happen for a while. But I can begin to not entertain that the thoughts that are arising are true. They're just a thought. Right? In other words, I can think, I'm the king of the world. Right? It's just a thought. Right? In and of itself, it has no reality and has no power to affect anything. Right? On the other hand, if I believed it were true and started acting upon it, I could get into trouble. right? So, again, in Buddhism, it's really about understanding what's true and not. Is that clear? I don't know where you're going, but I just wanted to make, because it's important to get that one, because a lot of people think it's, I got to get rid of these thoughts, I got to stop these thoughts, I got to stop having these thoughts, which is hard. Because they, if you notice, they come of their own. I mean, most people don't go out of their way to produce pain-producing thoughts. but there's a kind of cultivation of them, consciously and unconsciously, that makes them, but most of the time they just kind of arise. That's why in meditation practice we say, practice begins with the second thought. I don't know if you've ever heard that. Practice begins with the second thought. Which means the first thought is just arising. Right? But it's what do we do with the second thought. It's really where practice begins. But go on. Does that...
Yes, very well. And I'm only doing a very thankful for you. It's wonderful. I've been doing this for my life. I'll receive it, please.
Yeah.
I see, in prayers, talking to the higher power, meditation, listening to the higher power. But if I'm listening, but I've asked a question, and I've commented the question in the meditative state. Now, if I'm loving an answer, and then I'm waiting for something, whereas I seem to be meditating,
again, we first of all, we're all different. That's one thing. and therefore, there's not one answer for all of us. In Buddhism we say there are, the Buddha said, 108,000 Dharma doors, which means there are 108,000, which means there are infinite number of ways to enter truth. And that's the teaching of the Buddha. He didn't say, there's only one way, it's a narrow gate, everybody's going to go through this one. It wasn't like that. So please understand that, that there is that creative aspect to practice. On the other hand, different practices at different times. If you're saying I use kind of centered prayer or something to look for direction in my life where I pray and then I open and I wait for an answer, right? There you're talking about kind of the way you approach seeking some guidance in your life, some inner guidance, right? That's right. But that not necessarily is what we're doing in mindfulness meditation. It doesn't mean that that's wrong, or it doesn't mean that that can't be used. It just means, sort of like, if you ever play a musical instrument, you don't only practice one piece. Right? You may practice different kinds of pieces and different kinds of skills and different kinds of practice pieces and scales and different kinds of pieces and different kinds of music to develop yourself as a musician. In the same way, in your own spiritual cultivation, you don't just cultivate one thing. Right? Over here, you may find that opening prayer is very helpful and meaningful in some way. On the other hand, for learning to live in the present moment, you may find that pure mindfulness breath meditation is helpful to you. Is that clear? For understanding your mind, you may go just kind of learning to observe the workings of your mind without any attachment, and just, naming thoughts and like this is very helpful. So it's, we are human beings, we're fairly complex. And we have different aspects to ourselves, And, you know, we can work on different aspects the same way we did loving kindness meditation, right? Obviously, that's, you know, that works a little differently on us than the mindfulness, in the sense it really cultivates how we relate to one another. Well, we can say in mindfulness, we're really cultivating the capacity just to be very open and clear and spacious just of mind, while in the loving kindness meditation, we're really learning how to have an open heart and direct loving kindness, not just only people we like or just to ourselves, but all types of people. Does that make sense? So, good. Okay. Any other questions? So let us look at Master Lin Shi. I'm reading from a book called The Zen Teachings of Rinzai, translated from the Chinese by Ermengarde Schlegel, 1976. I don't know if this book is still in print. Rinzai, again, his name was Lin Shi, but when Lin Shi Buddhism, or Lin Shi Zen came to Japan, Japanese pronounced it Rinzai. So for those of you who read Japanese Zen, you come upon the Rinzai sect, it's Lin Shi. And again, so the Lin Shi tradition went to Japan, but it also went into Vietnam. And Thich Nhat Hanh, again, is in that same lineage. So this is a book of various anecdotes and short talks given by the Master Lin Shi. And this is 39. I don't know if it's 39 in this book or whether in the original book it was labeled this way. So here the master is saying, so he must have been addressing a group, his followers of the way. So just understand that this is probably a group of people who have come to his monastery, and they're either on retreat or just he is maybe every day or every, you know, he'd be in the meditation hall and he would give a talk. But he's talking to he's talking to the in crowd. He's talking to people who are already followers of the way. This is not a public talk. This is not talking comparative religion. This is not a talk about for people kind of interested in what Zen's about. He's obviously talking to people that he considers followers of the way. The way of awakening, the way of Zen. I'm not sure what the way is, the way of truth. And then he says, with his followers of the way, there are certain bald fellows. Bald fellows, he's probably referring to monks. Bald fellows. Certain bald fellows. And again, he was a monk. And it could be that he was addressing an assembly of monks. There are certain bald fellows who apply their effort inwardly, imagining themselves to be seeking in themselves the Dharma, capital D, for getting out of the world. Okay? Sounds good, right? So he's saying, you know, there are certain meditators, monks, who are applying themselves inwardly. And they are imagining, which means they are thinking in their mind that they're practicing the Buddha Dharma, they're practicing meditation, because they want to get out of the world, right? I think that's a fairly common view of spiritual practice, right? World's a mess. Too much suffering, right? I want to get out. I want to get out of it. I'm just beaten up by the suffering, the disappointment, the frustration of life, right? And I want to and I want to get out of this world. So, and then he says, they deceive themselves. Interesting. These people who imagine that they're practicing Dharma to get out of the world, they are deceiving themselves. And then he goes on to say, to seek the Buddha is to lose the Buddha. To seek the way is to lose the way. To seek the patriarch is to lose the patriarchs. Venerable ones, do not be deceived. So this is, you know, Rinzai Linshi. He's quite well known in Zen circles for his capacity just to cut away the forest so you can see the trees. To seek the Buddha is to lose the Buddha. Isn't that bizarre? Right? To seek God is to lose God. Right? Most of us think, oh, seeking is a wonderful thing, isn't it? How wonderful. Fred, what are you doing? I'm seeking the Buddha. Oh, how wonderful. Right? I'm seeking the way. I'm seeking to follow the patriarch. I'm seeking the patriarch. Right? I was going to say, what a noble guy that Fred is. Right? What a great spiritual practitioner. He's seeking the Buddha. He's seeking the Buddha's way. But Linshi, he's just saying, oh, Fred, he's just a bull-headed guy who's just deceiving himself. Right? Now, what does that mean? Again, this is very important. Because there are certain aspects of practice, of teaching, that we can get, that we can intellectually understand, and that maybe at some level have some experience of. But there's usually one big one that we just can't get. And that is that we are inherently right now Buddhas. Right? That one is not for most of us, our ever-present experience. That we experience ourselves on a moment-to-moment basis without any sense of separation, totally aware of our interdependence with all things, not in any way constrained by any sense of self, superior, inferior, it's totally free of it. Right? So for many of us, we conceive ourselves as, deluded, right? As ignorant, as less than. And so therefore when we want to become different, right? When we want to change, we want to become, we think we have to go somewhere, we have to go get something, right? Again, he doesn't mean don't follow the Buddha. This is deeper than in the realm of appearances. He's saying at the most profound level,
the deepest level.
If you think the Buddha is something outside yourself, and that is the way you're going about practice, then you'll never find it. You'll never find the Buddha. You lose the Buddha. Why? Because you are the Buddha. And the experience of Buddhahood is only experienced now, in the present, as you are. It's already here. Now that may be hard for us to understand, especially if we're not in a good way today. Right? So it's something that we have to take on faith, but it has, we'll go on, it has implications for how we practice. We don't want to turn our spiritual life, our spiritual search, our desire for transformation into a search after concepts. We want it to be real. So somebody says, I seek to know God. Now again, in Buddhism there is no God, but there's Buddha. And I think when you ask people what is God to them, and they begin to define what the meaning of God is to them, it sounds very much like Buddha or Buddha nature or anything else. But people say, oh well, God is imminent in everything, right? Isn't that what people say? God is everywhere. If God is everywhere, then he has to be here. Right? Right here. And if God is right here, where else can I search for him but right here? Right? I mean, he can't be in the future. He can't be somewhere else and not here, right? I mean, he's not over there, is he? If he's over there, then he also is here. There's no place where he's not. There's no place, if our nature is Buddha nature, then we are never separate from our nature, right? If we were a fish and somebody says, go find water, where would you look? Right? I mean, where would we look for air? Go find air. The essence of life. Huh? Air is right here, isn't it? A fish is already in water. Where does it have to go to find water? That is why in the practice is at the deepest level is only about penetrating this moment, penetrating this mind right now, right? Living, learning to be totally here, right? If we search for the Buddha's way, if we search for the patriarch, when do we search for them? In every activity of our life. That's what only put, you know. You know, there are some people like we do loving kindness meditation, right? I mean, if we want to be a loving person, where else are we going to be a loving person but in our life, in how we relate to people all throughout the day, right? If we turn, I want to be a loving person, like a loving person is a thing, like an object, like a picture, like something to be imagined, that's not real, is it? And you probably run into people who imagine that they're loving people, right? You know, one can imagine they're anything, right? You know. But if you're a loving person, that your capacity, if you're really a loving person, then you're a loving person in how you are with people, right? No matter what you imagine yourself to be. So, we don't want to seek or make our spiritual life about something outside ourselves, something, you know, that I'm seeking to become. If I want to become a loving person, I can only become a loving person in terms of my daily life. That is my path. It's not seeking anything imaginary. If I say, you know, in Buddhism, Mahayana Buddhism, people say, I want to be a Buddha. I want to be fully awakened. I want to dedicate my life to selflessly serving all beings and really help liberate them from their suffering. I mean, that's a wonderful goal, human ideal, right? But that can only occur where? In life. Right? People say, well, I'm practicing selflessness. You know, how can you practice selflessness by yourself? Right? I mean, you know, if you're practicing selflessness by yourself, we'll all look pretty good. Right? On a desert island, I'm practicing selflessness. Right? We all look pretty good. But if we're really practicing selflessness, we can only do it in the friction of life, in the friction of selves and egos and competing needs and wants. Where else are we going to learn that to let go, right, of our selfishness? Except in the midst of life. So is giving very strong Zen teachings. And it's weird, you see back, this is like 9th century in China. And this is, you know, in a monastery, and imagine the people who come to him are seekers, right? Very strong, they're living with him, they're practicing with him, meditating with him, and he's telling them, you know, don't make the path, don't make your spiritual life into something imaginary. Keep it real. Then he goes on to say, or do not care whether you are well versed in sutras and treatises. I do not care whether you are imperial ministers. I do not care if your eloquence is like a mountain torrent. I do not care whether you are sagacious and wise. I only care whether you have true and genuine insight. Bingo. I don't care how many books on Buddhism you've read. I don't care how many books on Buddhism and spiritual matters and philosophy and stuff you've written. I don't care how high up you are in the social hierarchy. I don't care how eloquent you are and how well you can spout forth spiritual truisms. Right? I only care whether you have true and genuine insight. Do you really get it in your own heart mind? That's what it is. It's not just up here. We have to be very careful, right? We often think because we intellectually understand something that we mean we have the capacity to live it. Do you know what I mean? We have to be careful. We don't just want to be people who have an intellectual understanding or have a verbal understanding. That will not get us anywhere if we're somewhere we want to get to in terms of our true transformation. He said, I only care whether you have true and genuine insight. True and genuine insight into what? Into yourself, into ego, into mind, into what causes you suffering, into what makes you happy. Right? You have understanding of that. Right? That's what really matters, you say. And how do you know whether you have true and genuine insight? Well, traditionally, from a personal meditative view, people would have teachers, right? I mean, we know in the Buddhist meditative tradition, going back to the Buddha, it has been a transmission of teacher and disciple. Now, the reason it's always been that mentor-mentoree relationship is just because we know in any craft, right? In any craft, you need to be mentored, right? Somebody better show you, if you want to be a carpenter, how to use a hammer, right? Somebody better show you whether your corners, your mortise and tendon joints are really good ones, or whether you're sloppy, right? If you don't have a mentor, no matter what you do, whatever your profession, you know, we need somebody to correct us, don't we? Right? That's why we have teachers. And teachers don't always give us a pat on the back and give everybody A's and everybody hundreds. Right? A good teacher tells us, you don't know this. You know? This paper stinks. You can do better. Right? Go back and write something. Right? We need teachers like that, don't we? If we want to develop. I mean, if all we want to do is feel good, right? Then having a teacher who always tells us we're doing wonderful and we're going to, it will make us feel good, but we may not become very competent in our craft, right? To be competent in our craft, we need somebody who who tells us we're on the right path, when we're on the right path, who positively reinforces us when we're right, but also is willing to tell us, ooh, that teaching just played stinks, right? You can do better, right? That's a good teacher, isn't it? That's not a bad teacher, that's a good teacher. Who shows us, that shows us how to play the piece. Encourages us. So, in the Buddhist tradition, traditionally, because it is a mentor-mentor, going back to the time of the Buddha, we have a living mentor to make sure that our insight is genuine and true. But the other thing, of course, is we have the proof of our daily life, right? Which is also a good feedback loop, right? Are my relationships more harmonious? Am I less selfish? Do I find that I'm more patient, kinder, friendlier, open, right? In my daily life? If I'm really honest with myself. So, again, if we're lucky to have, to be working with a teacher, that's a great feedback loop. We have the feedback loop of daily life if we're open, if we're clear, and we're really, not deluding ourselves, we'll get feedback in terms of our spiritual practice. And then, in Buddhism, we have the phrase of kalyanamitta, or spiritual friend. A spiritual friend is sort of like can be a peer, can be a little bit of an elder, not necessarily like it's your teacher, but somebody who's willing to to reinforce you in a positive way when you're on the path and you're hitting correctly, but also willing to say, hey, there is another way to do this. Or, that's a little bit of, hold the mirror up to us, we could say. Yeah. If we're really practicing spiritual path, and we're really open, and we really want to change, we don't want people running around, being critical to us, pointing out all our faults. We're not talking about that. But we appreciate a dear spiritual friend holding up a mirror to us. Hey, you're a little off base. Right? Those are lost days. You can do better than that. You just see that you're really holding on to something. What's going on with you? Right? We need somebody to hold up a mirror. And so sometimes, again, our teachers hold up mirrors to us, life holds up mirrors to us if we're attentive to it, but also we can have friends who from time to time, a good friend, will also hold up a mirror to us. When we get off the path. Followers of the way. Even if you know how to explain and interpret 100 volumes of the sutras and treatises, these are the Buddhist teachings. Even if you know how to explain 100 and explain and interpret 100 volumes of sutras and treatises, better it is to be peaceful and a master who has nothing further to seek. Again, he's saying, even if you have great, and we have to understand the historical role that Zen played in Buddhism. Okay. Please remember, I think we've talked before, that Buddhism had been in China for hundreds of years before the Zen teaching arose. The temple system, the monastic system, the religious system, the monastic system, the philosophical systems, had all been in China and flourishing, right? But when Zen appeared, it was a kind of a reformation of a Buddhism that had become overly intellectual, overly philosophical. And it kind of went, let's get back to basics. You ask, You know the sutras back and forward. You know the Buddhist teachings backwards and forward. Yes, your explanations are eloquent. Yes, people come from all around to hear your eloquent explanation of the Dharma. So what? If you don't have genuine insight, if you aren't really living it, if you haven't really used the teachings to really uproot your own suffering, if you haven't freed yourself from narcissism and self-centeredness and egocentricity, then all your intellectual understanding is all in the service of what? Big ego. So it says, even if can explain 100 volumes of sutras and treatises, better it is to be peaceful, a peaceful human being who has nothing further to seek. Again, you get this a lot in Zen. Nothing further to seek. You have nothing further to seek when you what? When you come to realization. Right? You're no longer seeking anything. You know it's right here. Right? You know there's nowhere to go to get. You know you're not going to get it in books. We're not haunting Barnes and Nobles anymore. We're not hunting, we're not. Our bookshelves are not growing the way they used to. There's nothing further to seek. And I know, because I know that my seeking, my transformation, it only comes in terms of how I live my life. Better to have nothing further to seek than to put oneself at ease. Now, this is not an invitation to go home and watch TV. Go home, I'll just go home and mix myself up with a nice stiff martini and put on Jeopardy and just be at ease. What? Somebody might say, yeah, I can be with that. Right? That probably is people seeking to be at ease when they do that, right? I'm not diminishing that. It's a certain kind of ease. But it is an ease that does not come from understanding. It is an ease that is just produced by external circumstances, and when one doesn't have those things that produce that ease in oneself, one will no longer be at ease. It does not mean that in the world there are not many, 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 many inventions that human beings have not developed to put themselves temporarily at ease, to give themselves temporary feelings of happiness, well-being. There are many ways within the human, ordinary human realm to experience these things on a short-term basis. But because they are externally driven or temporarily driven, they are always followed by their opposite. Ease is followed by being ill at ease, which makes one seek ease again, which is followed by being ill at ease, right? Or always falling in and falling out. So, what we want from our meditative path, our spiritual path, our path of understanding and compassion, healing, transformation, whatever we call it, is something that comes from the inside and that is always available to us and is not in any way externally driven or externally dependent. As long as it's externally driven or externally dependent, our happiness, our well-being, our ease, we will always never be free. We'll always be dependent. We won't be truly interdependent. So better to have nothing further to seek and to put oneself at ease. That's what we're learning when we meditate, right? We're learning how to put ourselves at ease. I don't need Michael's approval to be at ease. I don't need this to be at ease. I don't need this person to like me to be at ease. I don't need to be this kind of success to be at ease. I don't need anything to be at ease. I know how to put myself at ease. Right? And that's a great gift, isn't it? There's a great freedom in that. That's spiritual freedom. Where it's not dependent. You have the keys. It's nothing that somebody else has, and nor is it some kind of esoteric metaphysical problem that needs to be, kind of indirectly, symbolically unlocked. It's very, I know how to put myself at ease. I know how to put my mind at ease. I know how to put my body at ease. And I know how to put other people at ease.
Okay. And then it says finally, he ends,
and this is quite famous in the annals of Zen. He says, when hungry, I eat my food. When sleepy, I shut my eyes. Fools laugh at me, the wise understand. It's a very, very famous line. So again, if you have nothing further to seek, and if you're living a life at ease, then what does that mean? What is the spiritual life? What does it look like? What does the life look like of the great Dharma Zen realization look like? We think it looks like what? Walking on water. Right? Don't we? That's what we're looking for. Right? We think it's lights coming out. Auras, right? That's what we think. That's. And he's saying, what does it look like? When hungry, I eat. When sleepy, I shut my eyes. Which means, again, it is totally natural. We're no longer living from how we should live, concepts of anything. We're totally at ease. Right? Yeah. That's what that, in that little phrase, is a life of ease. A life of naturalness, right? I'm not constrained. I can't eat this. It's like, it's all easy. You never do yourself harm. You don't struggle with what food should I eat, good food, bad food, I shouldn't eat chocolate, We're always beating ourselves up, we're struggling about everything. Rather than letting our own natural wisdom just tell us, at ease. You're tired, go to bed. Oh no, I got so many things to do. I got this and that. You're tired, go to bed. At ease. You're hungry, go get something to eat. That's all. Fools laugh at me, the wise understand. Because people will go, what? What does that have to do with a spiritual life, right? That's what he means by fools. But he said, people understand, well, the wise will understand what's going on here. Again, in the realm of spiritual masters, you will meet people who act spiritual. People will say, I met this guru. Wow, he was really spiritual. They just said, wow, lights were coming. Don't be fooled by spiritual personas. The wonderful thing when people meet the Dalai Lama, what do they say about him? Well, he's so human. He's so natural. When you're in his presence, you just feel good. Right? You feel he's 100% present to you. It's simple. It's not how I'm saying. When you meet a real spiritual master, you're meeting somebody of utter simplicity, utter total human. If you meet somebody who has a certain, just be careful. Because they're still carrying but in Zen they say, why, one head is enough. You don't need to grow a spiritual head. You don't have to grow a Zen head. You already have a head. That's good enough. When hungry, I eat my food. When sleepy, I shut my eyes. Again, but he's told you, this is the practice of mindfulness and awareness, right? We go through our life totally present, totally aware, everything's simple. What's the great mystery of brushing my teeth? But there's nobody brushing, it's just brushing. Just walking, just listening, just. This is the practice of sanity. Just being. Fools laugh and may the wise understand. And he ends by saying, follow the way, do not seek for anything in written words. You will tire your heart and inhale icy air without profit. What? Inhale icy air without profit. Any questions about this very simple but very direct teaching of Master Lin Shi? Yes. What?
Talking about seeking.
Seeking. Uh-huh.
And I get the part where you no longer allow shitty things and
Alright, so obviously at a certain level, we can say, yeah, I'm seeking. I'm seeking to be a better person, I'm seeking to be more peaceful, I'm seeking, alright. But what he's saying, he's talking here to people who are probably pretty well advanced along the way, and he's saying, yeah, that was okay then. What is your name?
Bar.
What?
Bar.
But understand, don't seek these things as if they're real, as if they're solid. Right? Don't get attached to them. Don't seek that they're, don't think that peace, love, happiness, well-being, healing is outside of yourself. Okay? In the beginning, before we know, there is that, right? That kind of gets us going, that seeking. Right? But at a certain level, we have to become finders. Seekers and finders. Seekers are always looking. Finders are people who find. You want to be, it's good to seek, right? It gets us probably out from where we started out from, right? Which is a place we want to leave. And so seeking kind of gets us going and gets us out there and gives us new experience and puts us in new places, right? But a certain place we want to find so we can come home. You know, the prodigal son, all those stories are all about that. You wander about here and there, seeking this, seeking that, and then you find what? The treasure was always at home. There's no place like home. Exactly. In the end, Dorothy came home. And she found out what? It might have all just been a dream. Yeah? She probably never left home. Just like that. In a certain way, you're absolutely right, there is some seeking, but what he's saying at a certain point, that seeking has to understand that, you're not, at some point you get it, at a certain point, the reading, the listening kind of opens things up for us and gives us some direction, but at a certain point, it has to become realization, which means it has to become real inside myself. At that point, I have to become a finder. I can't continue to be a seeker. So as usual, it's both and, it's not either or. Okay? So why don't we stop here, because it's time. Thank you.